Today's program is brought to you by Regional Access. Regional Access is a regional distributor committed to creating sustainable economies throughout the Northeast. For more information, visit regionalaccess.net.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And Alice Marcus Creek.
Yes, Alice is joining us via telephone today from the home office.
Yes, talk about transfiguration. I am a ghost.
That's right. I can hear you, but I can't see you.
That's right.
So we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design, build, and maintain gardens all around New York, even in the fall. And this show aims to bring some culture to horticulture. So today's show is all about symbolism in plants and in nature. And as always, this season, we have a horticultural honor roll. Thank you, Joe. So this week, we decided to honor a living person and not a dead German botanist.
What kind of Halloween show is this?
I know. You know, you got to be different. You got to get out of the box once in a while. So it's he's a contemporary living botanist. I feel like I'm on a dating show now and I'm introducing him.
Which botanist would you date?
Which botanist? Well, this botanist named John M. McDougall. We're honoring, and a genus of plants that has deep symbolism for Christians, the genus Passiflora. The Passiflora was encountered by the Spanish missionaries in the 15th and 16th centuries, and they were used as a teaching tool to convert the natives to Christianity. I'm going to read to you from our guest's book a description of how the different parts of the flower represented aspects of Christianity. The sharply pointed leaves represented the lance that pierced Jesus' side. The plant's tendrils represented the lash of the whips used in the flagellation of Christ by the Romans. 10 petals and 10 sepals stood for the apostles who were loyal to Christ, leaving out St. Peter, who denied Jesus, and of course Judas Iscariot. The shape of the ovary was compared to a chalice or the Holy Grail. The filaments were like the crown of thorns. The stigmas stood for nails. And the anthers recall the wounds of the lance and nails. The flowers, blue and white colors, the same as the robe worn by the Virgin Mary, symbolize heaven and purity. So that's a lot of symbolism in a flower.
So which came first, the religion or the flower?
Right? Well, the species that honors our contemporary botanist is called Passiflora McDougalliana, and it was discovered in Panama in 1982 by Sandra Knapp and James Mallett, who named it for John McDougall because he has made this genus of plants his life's work. In fact, he's written a new book about Passiflora along with Torsten Ulmer that's available from one of our favorite horticultural presses called Timber Press. So the reason I also wanted to honor somebody living is it just shows that these recent discoveries point to the importance that botanical work still has in our time and that needs to be supported to understand, you know, our environment and our role in it on the planet.
Exactly.
So as humans, we've been trying to understand nature and our place in the cosmos since we appeared on the planet as a species about 200,000 years ago. And since recorded history, we've created legends, myths, and stories to try to pass on our beliefs. So we thought it was fitting, Alice and I, that this week, with Halloween just a few short days away, we would focus on some of the mythology associated specifically with gardening and plants, tales of death, ghosts, and people transforming into flowers and trees. And in my view, nowhere is the death/life cycle more evident than in the garden. Every gardener experiences this, dichotomy on many levels on an annual basis. So our guest today is Cheryl Humphrey, who has written a great book on the subject called The Haunted Garden, Death and Transfiguration in the Folklore of Plants. Cheryl, thank you for joining us.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, I would be remiss in not mentioning that today is the anniversary of Sandy, the Hurricane Sandy, which affected so many New Yorkers. And I know that you're a New Yorker, and I wondered how have you recovered from Sandy?
Well, we were extremely fortunate to not have had too much impact from it, but I'm still seeing such a strong impact among many friends who lost so much and had their lives turned upside down. So,
yes, you're on Staten Island, right?
A slow rebuild, and you know.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to note that because it strangely enough, we've had the opposite weather this fall, extremely dry. Couple of months. So
exactly.
And I'm very actually grateful for that.
Well, for instance, I just read today that the public library at Coney Island just reopened.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would have been very important to me if I lived in Coney Island, and, you know, it's been pretty incredible.
So it's good to remember that people are still being affected, and it's still in the process of being, you know, so many people are still not back to 100%. So Cheryl is an author, as I mentioned. She's also an artist and also an online bookseller. And we met her, as we meet so many of our guests, on Facebook with her intriguing posts featuring really cool paintings and other artwork. So Allison, I really wanted to have you on the show, but I have to ask you kind of the obvious question, Cheryl. What led you to writing this book? It's such an interesting little book.
Well, I guess the initial idea began many years ago when I first made my very first attempt at gardening after I got married. This is like over 25 years ago. And I just planted some chive seeds in a pot. And I was so thrilled when they grew and they bloomed. I wanted to try my hand at more herbs. And I like to research things, so I wanted to read up about the herbs. And when I read about them, I saw they had so much folklore associated with them, I guess because they're so important as food and medicine, you know,
yes,
as a group of plants. And from there on, I began to garden a lot more seriously and to read more seriously about plants and their legends. And as I would read things, and this was, you know, kind of before you could just go buy anything online.
Yes.
I mean, I would seek out things in bookstores and libraries and yard sales, trying to find, you know, anything I could about it. And when I would read about these plants, I was struck by how many times either the origin of the name or the plant itself was derived from myths and legends where somebody died or died and or were transformed into a plant. And I thought that would be really interesting to gather all these into a little book.
Uh-huh.
And then by the time, decades later, when I was fortunately given the opportunity to do something with this idea with the Staten Island Arts Council, I got a grant from the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. And when I was able to do research online, it was pretty overwhelming because it's just so pervasive in all cultures and all times where, you know, these legends, you know, up until contemporary culture. And so this is just really a sampling of some of the more notable ones, and I hope to expand it as the years go by.
That would be great. Cheryl, we want to kind of start at the beginning. Your book covers a lot of ground, and it is a small volume, but it has so many great stories. And you start with the Greeks and the Romans and Ovid, whose stories are the foundation of so much of our Western cultural and literary traditions. Some of the stories almost everybody knows, Narcissus and Echo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them that you include in the book are a little bit more obscure. One that was new to me was the myth of Mira. Will you share that story with our listeners? It's a really good one.
Yeah. Well, so many of these plant transformation myths are really violent and intense. these ancient Greek and Roman stories, but this one about Mira is really one of the most shocking. If you don't mind, I'll just read it. It's brief. The myth of Mira has many versions, the best known probably being the one found in Ovid's Metamorphoses. The tale is strange and deeply disturbing, the story of an obsessed young woman, incest, transfiguration, the birth of a god, and musing on the taboos that serve as demarcations between nature and civilization. Mira, who could have had her pick of princes, fell in love with her father, Cinyrus, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, and tricked him into sexual intercourse by posing as another woman. When he discovered her true identity, he raised his sword at her, but she fled. For 9 months, she was on the run and pregnant by her father. Fearing both the condemnation of living and the damnation of dying, she prayed to the gods, "Make me a thing that neither lives nor dies." She was immediately transformed into a fragrant myrrh tree, her human tears turning into myrrh resin. Still pregnant, even though she was now a tree, Mira, attended by dryads, gave birth to a boy, Adonis, who goes on to have many plant transformation
himself
myths of his own.
Isn't that amazing, Alice?
I love that. What plants did you get started writing this book with?
I couldn't tell you what particular one, but my guess is, that it had to have been one of the herbs. It was so long ago. Probably, I was interested in the herbs that have to do with, witchy stuff. And not just myths and legends. But that's a good question. I'd have to really trace that back, but I can't say right offhand.
Yeah, that's it's kind of like asking what your favorite plant is.
It was an accumulation, really, more than one specific.
Yeah.
Well, there's another interesting story, also a well-known story, but that has a kind of different... a different angle and a different ending. The story of Cinderella. Everyone knows the familiar fairy tale, the Disneyfied version, where there's a fairy godmother, etc. But there's a different version. I think you mentioned in the book that was written by the Brothers Grimm, right? Where there's association of trees and death figures, pretty prominently, and that kind of replaces the benevolent fairy godmother. Can you tell us about that story?
Yes. Well, Cinderella is a folktale that's got variants from all around the world, but the Brothers Grimm one, sometimes known as Ash Maiden, there's no fairy godmother. So let me just read, please. This darker tale begins with the death of Cinderella's mother. The woman is buried in the garden, and her loving young daughter visits the grave daily. Cinderella's father remarries. Hold on 1 second, please. And in this version, Cinderella is treated cruelly by her stepmother and stepsisters. The stepsisters ask the father to bring them expensive clothes and jewels from his travels, but Cinderella requests only the first twig, dear father, that brushes against your hat when you turn your face to come homeward. Her father saves her a hazel twig from a green copse he passes through. Cinderella takes the twig, plants the cutting on her mother's grave, and cries so much over it that it rapidly grows into a thriving hazel tree. The tree on her mother's grave is where Cinderella pours out her grief and despair over her troubles. Soon a little bird nests in the tree and consoles her and talks to her about her problems, clearly channeling the spirit of the mother. The bird is also able to grant wishes and produces the elegant clothes that Cinderella needs to attend the grand ball. In the end, Cinderella and her prince are happily wed, but only after the stepsisters are gruesomely eliminated from the competition.
Now, that is not a Disney movie.
No, I wish it was.
It is
referred to in the Broadway musical, Stephen Sondheim.
Oh.
Where it's a song Cinderella is singing to her mother in the tree. There's actually, there's a tree and someone singing out of the tree.
Well, I think that makes a much more interesting tale. Well, we have to take a little bit of a break, Cheryl. Stay tuned. When
okay.
we come back, we're going to listen to some more tales.
All right.
We dig plants.
Okay.
are listening to Four of Seven by HRN's own Jack Inslee on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Regional Access. Regional Access is a regional distributor committed to creating sustainable economies throughout the Northeast. This community-oriented company was built on a vision of providing ecologically responsible and ethically produced food to area consumers. During a typical week at the Regional Access warehouse, they help move thousands of pounds of natural and grass-fed meat, gallons of farm-fresh dairy, and tons of organic and specialty foods from producer to market. Having been in the distribution business for almost 25 years, Regional Access's experience and knowledge make them uniquely equipped to build out their region's food web. Up in the Finger Lakes, Regional Access will continue to champion the region's bounty and work toward a sustainable food system for the entire Northeast. For more information, visit regionalaccess.net.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are here with Cheryl Humphrey, author of The Haunted Garden, Death and Transfiguration in the Folklore of Plants, just in time for Halloween. Cheryl, we were kind of focusing on the Western traditions a little bit, and now I'd like to turn away from that and go to India and discuss the story of holy basil, or the plant known as Osimum sanctum. Tell us about the myths associated with the plant that they call Tursi.
Yes, Tursi or Tulsi.
Mm-hmm.
It's dedicated to the Hindu god Vishnu, and it's considered to be an incarnation of a goddess named Tulsi, who was Vishnu's wife or his consort. And she was a mortal woman of great piety, and she was very, very devoted, even though she was mortal, she was very devoted to the god Vishnu, and when her mortal husband died, she threw herself on his funeral pile, sacrificing herself, and in return for that sacrifice, Vishnu transferred her soul to the holy basil. And another legend, the Hindu legend, holds that the holy basil is actually Lakshmi, another one of his chief consorts, in disguise. And because he feels sympathy with her and she's incarnated in the plant, it's very bad to hurt or damage the plant because you are hurting or damaging Vishnu when that happens. And he will not hear your prayers if you are somebody who damages the plant.
So people plant it on, how do people in India use the holy basil then? Are they allowed to use it, are they allowed to cut it or use it in any sort of rituals, or is it something that's just planted and left?
Well, I'm not sure exactly the answers to all those questions, but I know that they would wear rosaries where they made them from the seeds of the holy basil, and they would use the leaves in sacred rituals. But I guess just the planting, is to be done ritualistically and, you know, with great respect and great care. And one of the death symbolism of it is that a leaf of the plant placed on the body at death helps ensure that the soul is welcomed into heaven.
Wow.
And interestingly, it was also an herb associated with death in ancient Egypt, and they would strew the flowers from the holy basil over the final resting places of their loved ones. And also in Iran and Malaysia, it was planted, not strewn, but planted on the graves. So, not
Tursi
in India.
Well, let's talk about Coluna vulgaris, the heaths and the heathers that cover the hills of Scotland. That has a pretty macabre origin. And you talk a lot in your book about the themes of death from violent and unnatural causes. And you write that these deaths can lead to fear, anxiety, and superstition within a population. So can you tell us a little bit about the Coluna and how that transpires?
Yeah, this legend is one of many where in some way
blood that gets spilled in war, in wartime battle, uh-huh. becomes flowers, and the battlefields burst into bloom. A modern example being in World War One, the association with red poppies and the poem about the battle in Flanders Fields.
Yes.
But the heath and the heathers were associated in Scotland with all the fierce fighting that had occurred between the early Christians and the natives, the native Picts. And the Picts were resisting the missionaries, these armed missionaries' orders that they convert to Christianity. And so much of their blood, of the vanquished Picts, was spilled on the battlefield. And they were called heathens, and then which led to the name Heather or Heath. And
oh, heathen. Oh,
yes.
So it's like
the
legend
connection?
Is that the
yeah.
heather was forever stained with their blood.
Uh huh.
And always associated with a sense of savagery in battle.
I put that question in for you, Alice, because of your Scottish heritage.
I'm learning a little more every day.
No, I you know, I never made the funny thing is I never made the connection between heath
right,
and heathen.
Right.
I did not make that connection. And only by when I read that story, Cheryl, did I understand.
Yeah.
You know,
don't forget, though, a lot of these things are fungible and maybe debatable. It's because we're going back into the mists of time and
sure.
How things get retold over.
But the words probably have a similar similar origin at least.
Yeah.
Well, we would be remiss being that this radio station is so much focused on food and food advocacy that I have to talk about the chapter that you include on the origin of staple foods from
mm-hmm.
around the world.
Right.
And you have a broad range from the story of the Cherokee mythical corn mother Selu, to one that I thought was really interesting and a less well-known tale of the breadfruit, Arctocarpus altilis. That is the staple food of the Polynesian people. Can you tell us that story and why you included that one in the book?
Yeah, I chose to include it because it's a really good example of the theme of human death. Often a parent sacrificing themselves,
mm-hmm.
giving rise to the creation of a staple food that sustains an entire community ever after. And in this story, it said it was a long time ago, people only had red earth to eat, and there was a husband and wife who had one child, a son they loved very much, but he was very sickly, and he couldn't eat the red earth, and he was wasting away. And the father noted this, and he told the mother, "I fear our son will die because he can't eat the red earth that we eat. He needs food. So I will die and change into food for him. I will pray to my God and help me do this." And so he tells his wife these elaborate plans, and he says, "My prayer has been answered. I will die soon. When I'm dead, you must break up my body into pieces, bury them in different places around our yard. Go inside and wait, and then you'll hear a sound like a ripe fruit falling on the ground. And when you go out, it will be me, and I have become food for the boy." So the wife does all this, buries his body, waits all night, and hears the sound. And when she goes outside, she sees this beautiful, mature tree covered with ripe breadfruit. And they gather the breadfruit. They make an offering to the god who enabled the transformation, give some to their king, and then they roast it and ate the rest. And the boy got well, and the people thrived.
Pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
Chop me up into pieces, bury me in the yard.
But again, it's an idea that's, you know, not just in one geographic area. It's like that's a motif that it reoccurs.
Yeah, that's what makes it so interesting is that the commonality, like even though, you know, really diverse cultures separated by time and space have
right.
similar myths, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's really amazing.
And then you end the book on a very serious note as well, which is the concept of humans being changed into plants, having acquired a new twist with the alarming rise of genetically modified organisms in corporate agriculture. So do you think this is possible that the manipulation of genes in our food supply could somehow lead to strange human slash vegetable mutations?
Well, I mean, I don't literally think it's like we're all going to become like Swamp Thing, but
right.
at this point, I wouldn't rule out the possibility of something,
yeah.
you know, weird or bad happening, and I feel that with the inadequate government regulation and the lack of labeling for the consumer, and we have almost zero transparency from these giant corporations pushing these foods on us, who knows what's really going on with these genetic manipulations.
Yeah, and I think that's what your book
plant,
kind of touches on, you know, this kind of past, but where is it going, you know, to the future? That's what's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, up until now, it was just myth,
right? Right.
But maybe some kind of strange reality might happen if we don't.
And I don't want Monsanto to be the powers that are causing this. I want nature to be the powers that are, you know, leading to the myths.
Exactly. You and Darwin.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your passion for art and for myth with our listeners today. Would you mind sharing your website and your blog with our listeners so that they can follow you and they can see the wonderful pictures that you post weekly?
Yes, thanks for giving me the chance. Actually, I try to post daily on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on Facebook at The Haunted Garden Book. And it's also on Tumblr at hauntedgardenbook.tumblr.com. And you can see my art at cherylhumphrey.tumblr.com. And you can buy the book at Etsy at etsy.com, Cheryl Humphrey. It's also available on Amazon.
It's a great book. It's less than 100 pages. It's a great read for Halloween, and it really helps you to put some of the stories that we kind of take for granted in perspective. So I hope that you all buy it and share it. Cheryl, thanks again. Our show is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Joe G. An archive of the show is available at heritageradionetwork.org, Weedic Plants, and available for free anytime on iTunes. Please join our Facebook page, Groundworks Inc. Weedic Plants, and check in tomorrow to find out who won our prize this week. You have to be a Facebook friend to be eligible to win one of the prizes. Okay, thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.